Hello, this is Brooke Devard, and you're listening to the Naked Beauty Podcast. I'm not even going to take a lot of time with this intro because I am so eager to get into this conversation with Tariq Ali. Tariq is someone that kind of came across my page as I was scrolling and just listening to different voices, and I love the vulnerability in which he spoke. I loved the candid conversations he was having about self-love and about healing himself. And Tariq is really interesting because he's exemplary of a generation who navigated adolescence and young adulthood online. He basically grew up on the internet. And Tariq is also someone who used to share everything about their life, but that also comes with consequences. And as he's grown older, he's renegotiated what and where he shares and how he chooses to show up. He leads with vulnerability, which is incredibly brave, and he's the type of person who makes others feel okay in themselves and able to reject shame. I so love this conversation. I'm so excited for you all to hear it. Before we get into today's conversation, I would like to give a trigger warning for sexual assault, drug abuse, and conversations about eating disorders. We cover difficult topics in this conversation, but there's a whole lot of light and levity and joy in the conversation as well. I'm so excited for you all to get to know him better. Let's get into the conversation. You'll know real when you get it. It will say eBay Authenticity Guarantee, and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like a gem, sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. When it comes to style and luxury, eBay gets it. They're making sure the things that you love are checked by experts. Not just any experts, specialized experts. Real people who love this stuff with real hands-on authentication experience. So when you see that shiny blue check mark that says authenticity guarantee, shop with confidence. Every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. That's how you know eBay's got your back. Because when you finally step into those sneakers, put on that watch, get your real gold glow up, swing that handbag over your shoulder, or step out in that streetwear, you'll realize that feeling is unlike any other. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms. This is Brooke Devard, and you're listening to the Naked Beauty Podcast. I'm joined by a very exciting guest. I'm just going to give a little bit of background in your bio before we get into everything. Mm-hmm. Okay. Tariq Ali is an award-winning storyteller, writer, creator, and actor well known for his powerful voice that sparks thought-provoking conversations and encourages self-acceptance, growth, and healing. Having experienced homelessness, poverty, sexual assault, and bullying for his race, obesity, and queerness growing up, Tariq turned to YouTube to share his journey at the young age of 15 in 2014. And now after 10 years of creating powerful content with over 200 million views, wow, across all platforms, Tariq is respected as one of the pioneers of social media who helped to normalize conversations about growth and mental health online before it was popular. Tariq, welcome to Naked Beauty. I am so excited to have you on.
Thank you for having me. That was so sweet.
Well, I mean, that's your work. And I didn't even get into all of the overachieving you were doing back when you were starting in high school. I actually, you know what I found in doing my research? I found your high school yearbook photo. Does it say, if you're pro-black but anti-gay, you don't want equality, you want privilege?
Period.
Wow. That was like the quote in your yearbook.
Yeah. I was really big on that. I was really loud in high school. I was really loud in high school. Like, I was that kid that was always on stage in the pep rally.
Okay.
And lunch on the stage. Like, I was annoying. I was really loud.
Tell me about your parents.
Mm-hmm. Which ones? So, my aunt and uncle took me when I was 15.
Okay.
But my mom and dad. So, I call my aunt and uncle my parents, but also my mom and dad are my parents as well. So,
okay.
You want to know about both?
I want to know about both.
Let's start with my dad. My dad... I am a daddy's boy. You know, we were really close when I was younger. My mom, she was in and out of my life. Both of my parents are now recovered addicts.
Okay.
And, you know, my dad was in the Marines. He does a lot of engineering work. He did a lot of things with his hands. And my mom, she was in and out of my life in my childhood. Like, my mom was in prison in some years. She got out, and I feel like through my childhood, she was, like, continuously trying. Mm-hmm. And so I really just saw her, like, trying to get back to living. Because, like, you know, with addiction, it's just, for some people, it takes them longer, and I just was watching her through my childhood get all of that together. But with my aunt and uncle, they took me when I was 15, and that was like my first time being in a domesticated house.
Okay.
Hold.
And now, is this in Maryland?
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh. So you know about PG?
Yes, I do.
Oh, you know about PG?
But get into it. Give me your description of it.
Okay, so yes. So the DMV, DC, everybody knows, is Chocolate City. But what a lot of people don't know is about Prince George's County, which is like outside of DC, which is in Maryland, mm-hmm. which is the most affluent black county in America. Most people always think it's like Atlanta, but it is Prince George's County.
Yes.
And a lot of celebrities that we know, Taraji P. Henson, Martin Lawrence, like, you know, they say DC because if you say Maryland, people think what? Baltimore.
Right.
So they say DC, but a lot of these people are from Maryland, and that's Prince George's County. So it's very black. Like, the police officers are black. My teachers were black. We were reading black authors. There was one white person in my high school, and his name was Charles. So, you know, my aunt and uncle took me in. My aunt was a pharmacist, and my uncle is a business owner. So my track coach called me Will Smith because he was like Fresh Prince. And it was the same story, kind of. Like, I was from humble beginnings, and then they brought me in, and they have a 3-bedroom home and upper middle class, and I had to learn and ask to go places and stuff like that. So they took me in at 15, and that's when I learned a different part of the world and life that I really didn't, I knew about, but it didn't seem attainable for me, you know? Being in underprivileged areas and stuff, mm-hmm. is just certain things. I had never been on a plane.
Wow.
I had never been on vacation. My vacation before my aunt and uncle took me in was going to my aunt and uncle's house.
Right, right.
Because they had a big house. So it was just so different. But yeah, so I love both of them. I love both of my parents. But yeah, they just play different parts and roles in my life. Yeah.
I asked about your parents because I think you have an incredible work ethic. And even just reading about your young life, all of the things you did, you just mentioned track. I didn't even know track was part of that, but like interning at a hospital, applying for the MTVU program. Like, I would imagine you were a straight A student.
I hate that I have to say yes.
No, listen, as was I. But that like desire to do all of these things, all these extracurriculars, achieve. And some could argue that that means that you're maybe searching for some sense of self-worth tied to achievement.
Absolutely.
But I was asking about your parents because usually that comes from somewhere, right? Like you see that modeled somewhere. You were also in a completely new environment and still had that desire to achieve so much. You didn't feel uncomfortable about, I guess, going out for the track team or joining the certain club or putting the quote we shared at the top of the show in the yearbook. You felt at home even though you were from a totally different background.
It's so interesting. I love that you bring that up because when it comes to overachieving, right, like there is like a ceiling of like, oh, I'm fulfilled.
Right.
And then there's like, I want to keep going because of what this is giving me.
Right.
And for me, I talk about this in like episode 4, I think, of my podcast. It's the end of trauma and how to feel before you heal. Mm-hmm. Because all my life, really, those years, I was working hard. I used trauma as my life coach. Mm-hmm. Like, whenever I wanted something or I had a goal, I would just really just think about all the stuff I had been through. And I was like, I'm not going back there. So we going to get up and we going to do this bio. We going to do this chemistry. We're going to get an A. And then also, I was juggled through homes a lot. And so every home I went to, it just felt like I had to have a reason for them to take care of me. And if I was a straight A student, I spoke well and I cleaned and those things, I just thought I had to be perfect so that I could have my basic needs, shelter, food, and all those things. So, of course, when I got to my aunt and uncle's house, this is different, okay? Y'all go to internships and y'all doing all this. I'm like, I gotta step it up, okay?
Right.
So, yeah, I did what I did as a child, what I thought I had to do to survive, which was be a 4.0 student, do all these internships, and, you know, I enjoy learning. I'm a nerd. So it wasn't hard for me, but that's really where a lot of that success came from. I wanted to be seen. I wanted to be safe. And I've always been an artist. So it was me just trying to find a way to mix all of those things together, really.
And being an artist with a great work ethic is like the best combination there is.
Baby.
Especially here in LA, right?
Oh,
because
baby.
When I got here and people were like, I was like, oh, people don't really work that hard here. If I work really hard.
People don't really work that hard.
If I bring my New York work ethic over to the West Coast, what can I achieve, you know, working hard?
Yeah.
But there is always a dark side to having a really strong work ethic and wanting to constantly achieve success. So for you, how does that manifest? Like, what is the downside of having a really strong work ethic?
I think I've gotten to a good place of distinguishing. It's always the why. The why always gets you to like the balance and the healthy part of it, because I am naturally a hardworking person. I love working hard. And that's because I work on things I care about. Now, if I don't care about it, you won't catch me working hard.
I fully relate.
You bring me to a basketball court, girl, or you want, okay, cool. I don't care.
Right.
But with something I care about, it's natural for me to want to give my all and put my all into it. So how I do manage that, because then what happens is it becomes a problem when you make what you love and your art your job, right? And then it's different because, like, even when you're supposed to be resting because you love doing it, oh, I'm working, and it's a Saturday,
right?
And it's 2 p.m., and it's like then you're working every day.
Right.
So for me, I always have to ask myself, why am I doing this? And if it's making me feel good, even if it is on a Saturday or a Sunday or Tuesday, if it's fulfilling me, it's not work. But if it's like I'm doing it because, oh, this has to get done, or because of the pressure of something else, it's just always asking myself why and having clear boundaries.
Sure.
Really clear boundaries with myself on this is when I work, this is when I don't.
Interesting. Now, it's interesting because I don't feel capable of doing that, because I feel I will be relaxing and taking a bath and I'll be like, I should, in my head, I should do a series on all of the best bath accessories to have to optimize your bath routine. Oh, and what if I did like little naked beauty meetup where we all just went to different spas around the world? And maybe I should do an email newsletter all about bath. It's like, even when I'm relaxing, I'm constantly. So what I've now done is just accepted it, like accepted that I'm going to always kind of thinking about it.
Exactly.
And now my new thing is, as long as I can maintain my physical well-being, meaning eat lunch, because I am, that's like, I don't know, for some reason I find it so hard to stop and just like eat a proper lunch, get sleep, not stay up until 2 a.m., 3 a.m.
Exactly.
I'm like, as long as I can do that, then it's okay if I'm always working all the time.
I have a question. What do you do when you get those ideas? Do you?
I write them down.
Exactly.
In a notebook with a pen.
And you just, okay. And so.
And I come back to them and I'll like highlight. Once I've achieved each thing, I write, I track everything.
And how often would you say you get those ideas? Like any idea? All the time?
Yeah, I mean, every hour.
You're an innovator.
Every hour, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's why I'm asking this, because I'm like, you're just like me. You're an innovator, you're a creator, and you're going to always be coming up with new things. And so something that has helped me, because I'm also, you know, I'm a writer, so I'll have... The way I write is I see it first. I'm a visionary, so I see it first, and I'll just keep replaying it and change one. I write in my head, so it's like, oh, what if next time she doesn't sit in the chair, she goes in the room? I replay. It's like watching a movie over and over. And what I do is that is who we are. We're always going to be creating. We're always going to be innovating. But it's the energy we put into each one that exhausts us. It's like meditation, that it teaches you, like, every time you get a thought, have it. Let it float away.
Right, right, right. Observe the thought.
And with understanding that is who we are naturally, if it's meant to be and meant to happen, you have to trust spirit that, oh, when I try to recollect this next week, it'll still be there.
Right.
Any idea that doesn't come back isn't worth it.
Right, right.
Because we are always coming up with ideas. We don't have to grasp them all. I used to think, oh, what if I don't remember this? What if I don't remember this? And it's like, if it's needed, it'll come back.
Interesting.
Yeah,
interesting.
Because we're always thinking. And that's what gives us anxiety, is because we think every thought needs attention when it doesn't. And it could be a great idea, like, oh, that's nice. But anyways, what were we going to eat for dinner? Because it'll come back if it's a great idea. It's a great idea.
Right, right.
You know?
I feel like my brain is almost 10 years older than yours, so I don't feel as confident that it's going to come back. I'm like, let me write it down, because I really may not remember.
But that, and I love that you said that, because what you're speaking to is building a stronger trust with yourself. Because that's what I heard. It's, I don't trust that it'll come back. But you have to have a trust in yourself. And also, when you start doing that and practicing it with yourself, yourself will start knowing, oh, we're not going to write this down, so we got to keep this locked in here for next week. We remember everything else. Come on, you have a 3-year-old son. That memory ain't that bad. You have to remember so much. I know.
Right.
So
right.
That same skill can be done creatively. I think it's just because we love our art so much and because it means a lot to us and we get a lot of ideas, we don't want to lose any because they're like our babies.
Right.
But the thing is, you won't forget your baby, just like you won't forget your 3-year-old son.
Right.
So you just got to trust yourself and know, I'm an artist. I'm great. I'll come up. And even if I don't get that one, I'll get a better one.
Yes.
That's the good part of ego that people don't like really tap into. Yeah.
Who are some of the writers you admire? TV writers, any writers?
Shonda Rhimes.
Okay.
I love Shonda.
Okay. I could see that.
Really?
Yeah. Well, just because, you know what? I love that you talk about sex so openly on your like YouTube channel and like you really get into it. And I feel like one thing that underscores all of her programming is there is a heavy dose of sex. But it's like thoughtful and it brings up interesting dynamics. So I could see, okay.
That is so interesting you say that because.
Because most people don't want to talk about sex, myself included.
I'm new here. I'm new here. That's why I said that's interesting because when I started doing content like a long time ago, I was in high school. So in my aunt Nicole. So I wouldn't even say liquor. I would say milk. I was like, oh, are you off that milk? Like, and I didn't talk about sex. And I just got to a place of allowing myself, one, to talk about anything that, because everything I talk about, it usually goes in a positive and healing direction. I'm not just like lollygagging. So I'm intentional about what I share, but that whole sex, that is new for me. I was always so coy and very like, I used to be very prudish. I did. And that's just because I thought I was better by holding myself so sacred and not having sex. And then as I just got older and also just, I'm like, having sex doesn't make you any less anything. It doesn't disqualify you for a job, a promotion, or any, like, it's, we all are having sex. Everyone's having sex.
Right.
That's how we all got here. Right. So it's like, why are we not talking about this?
Right.
And then when you also being a queer Black man, it's like, looking at like the statistics and like the different things of STDs and STIs, and not that it's just in the queer community, but just seeing how it was prominent and growing up, and I went to college in Atlanta, I was just like, oh, so these things are running rampant because we're not talking about it. And people aren't talking about it because it's shameful, but then people don't know how to do it safe and they don't know, it's we don't know anything because we don't talk about it. So I'm just trying to get more people to get more normal about it. It doesn't have to be all icky. We can be, there's many different ways to talk about sex.
Right,
Yeah.
Well, you are very comfortable with sharing a lot of your life online, right? and you've been doing it for 10 years, right? And you started at 15 sharing every facet of your life. What comes with that?
Oh, a lot. See, the good thing is I was able to grow up doing that. And the reason it's good for me is because before I used to share every facet of my life because I was a child. And one of the main reasons I started making content was because I wanted to be seen and I wanted to be heard. And I was an artist and I was doing so many things in healthcare. I just needed an outlet. And I didn't feel like who I was being seen and heard in the real world. So online, I talked on a camera, people tuned in and commented. I was like, okay, hey y'all, we friends. So I was young, I was sharing everything. But as I got older, I just started to value privacy more and just also seeing the value of being intimate with myself, with situations. Like, not everything needs to be shared. It's kind of like that inside joke you have with your best friend. And so now I am very open and transparent, but everything I share, there is a reason why. And I have a conversation with myself, not once, not twice. Like, it is a process where, am I okay with giving this to the world? Because it was a couple of years ago, 2020, where after years of just sharing everything, millions of views, I started, you know, trolling really got big. And I just started seeing my vulnerability being distorted and changed. And it sent me in a huge mental health, like, hole. I was having panic attacks. And it's actually what started my healing journey. So I just saw how harmful that was to me. And I love me more than anything. So I was just like, yeah, I have to be more, I want to ask myself, why am I sharing? But I had to heal that trauma, because the trauma that was pushing me to share, because I just wanted love, I just wanted acceptance, I just wanted to be seen, I wanted to be heard. But once I healed that, it was like, baby, I'm here. And we have all these people here, you know? And there was no need to be desperate for all of this out here. It was just like a, I'm happy.
it's interesting you talk about sharing as a need to be loved. And I wonder how many content creators that really dedicate their life to it have some sort of deficiency or void that they're trying to fill, right? Because it's not natural, right, to turn on the camera and speak to yourself.
I love that you said that. Oh, I love that you said that because it's weird. And I love that because when I started, people really emphasized the weirdness of it. Like, you have to be a bit crazy. Mm. At that time, this wasn't normal. Like, people didn't make content in that way. It was either television or a production.
Right.
To put up a camera and talk to yourself for 30 minutes.
Right.
And make jokes and laugh. Right. Like, we were kind of crazy. So I love that you said that because we were. But it just goes to show that we had a lot to say. The people who started, like, content creation in that way, they had audiences because they had something to say.
Mm-hmm.
And people wanted to sit there for 30 minutes. Not a minute or 30 seconds, but 30 minutes with their dinner. Instead of talking to their boyfriend or their best friend, they were sitting down with us. Right. And eating and watching TV. Right. So, I mean, watching us. So it's so interesting that you said it because it is very awkward.
Well, part of your journey as a creator has been growing and making mistakes. I listened to your episode mm-hmm. about getting canceled,
mm-hmm.
which I wasn't actually aware that you were canceled.
yeah.
It's a tough thing. And I would imagine.
I want to know your thoughts on that episode.
I have a lot of thoughts. Okay.
Oh, I know. I love it. I want to get all into it. Yeah.
Yes. I think there's an interesting distinction between being canceled for wrongfully canceled, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and then
mm-hmm.
being canceled for something that is kind of like deserved or like rightfully so. And I would say, in my opinion, you were rightfully called out
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
for things that you said, although in the past,
yeah,
it wasn't, some people are like truly like canceled for no reason, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's a whole different thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're called out for doing something that mm-hmm. I know you know is now wrong,
mm-hmm.
it must feel different.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So, for the people listening, I want to make it very clear.
Yes. Let's talk about what
so
happened.
So I was canceled in 2020. At this time, I had been doing YouTube for a long time. I don't remember, 6 years at that point.
Okay.
Yeah, 6-7 years. And this was like 2019 was my big blow up year.
Yes.
And so that was like the year that I came out to my dad and I was getting millions of views and everybody
knew
Tariq
Ali. You came out to your dad on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so pretty much I was known as, this was before TikTok,
mm-hmm.
this was before, I was known as the positive guy. Like just keeping it very simple, the positive guy. And what happened was they found something from my past that wasn't so positive.
Yes.
And that is the story, but I want to give you the meat. So the tweets, there. I got on Twitter when I was like 11. I was in the hood, and this was my diary. I grew up in a house with 11 people in a house, you know, so it's a lot of kids. I was queer. I was obese. And the phone, before Twitter, you texted 40404. That's how you tweeted. And
oh, yeah,
so
I remember.
I would literally, oh, you remember? You was on Twitter then? So many people don't know that because it was a very niche. People weren't on Twitter then. It wasn't a big thing. But, like, you know, I would tweet. And so I tweeted all of my thoughts, intrusive and not. So I tweeted, like, harmful things and colorist things. I tweeted things about rape. I tweeted things, a whole bunch of stuff. Yeah. Like, a whole bunch of nasty, crazy stuff. And those tweets resurfaced on Twitter, and it was a big moment because not the positive guy.
Right.
So that's pretty much what happened in 2020, and it just got really big. It got really popular.
Yeah.
It was blowing up, and it was the darkest time of my life, actually. But to answer your question, because your question was like, what was that like for me? You know, it was really hard for me to navigate mm-hmm. because it was so long ago.
Right.
And
it was 2013 or 2014.
And I was 12. So I didn't know. It was like, yes, this is wrong. And mm-hmm. yes, I said those things, but I didn't really know how to navigate that with who I was in today at
right,
the time.
Right.
Because if you looked on my channel, I was like, the thing was like, oh, he hates black women. But I was like, there's more black women on my channel than anybody else. It was just hard really to understand. And then also the internet, because the internet can have its own voice in a way where that's not what the real world reflects. And I'm happy that you asked about my childhood before, because I think it will give you context to how important the internet was to me. Mm-hmm. It was my safe space. It was how I was seen. In my life, I was just trying to be perfect so I'd have shelter, but online, I could be me. So I shared everything online. And I was like, oh, these are my friends. Like, they love, they're giving me the love. So when I got canceled, and where was home for me and safe for me was telling me that I wasn't worthy of love, it broke me. Like, broke me. And I didn't know who I was. So what happened was I started just believing everything, every tweet, every hate comment. I just started believing it. And I'm not, like, literally believing it. And I had never had panic attacks in my life, but I started having panic attacks. It just got really bad. It got really bad. And the only way out of that hole was to heal. And through that healing process, I realized that there was still some unconscious bias there. There was still some colorism, some texturism, some self-hatred in there. And so that's why I don't regret it. I'm so happy it happened. It helped me love my blackness more. It was more of God's doing than I feel like it was like an attack. I don't know. Everything in my life I can use. So I'm really grateful for that time. If it wasn't for that time, I wouldn't be a healer today.
Wow.
I wouldn't.
Now, what did you learn about black women in the fallout of these kind of tweets resurfacing? Because I think, you know, you made disparaging comments about dark-skinned black women. And often black women are the punching bag for everyone, you know? I would imagine that you had conversations with black women in your life after these tweets came out. How did those conversations go?
To be very honest with you, I didn't. And I'm going to tell you this, when I say I didn't, because again, I was 12.
Oh, no, I mean when everything came out, like more recently.
No, but that's what I mean, because all of my friends, like I said, I'm from PG, so all of my friends, like, they were gagged. They were, Tariq, did you say this?
Oh, I see, I see.
My mom was, Tariq. My sister was like, Tariq, you didn't say that. I was like, because my Twitter, you know when you're a kid and you say, bitch. I mean, like, that was what my Twitter was. It was, I was a kid using social media before social media is what it is now. But this was the time where people were calling everything on the internet the cloud. We didn't know what it was. And so none of my friends in my, they knew me. That wasn't me. But it was me from the past. So, like, it's so funny because I'm like, all of my friends and even people I knew years ago that, you know, and people, I'm saying black women that I knew years ago would send me long texts because it was a while and that it lasts. And they would just keep checking on me and saying, Tariq, I only knew you for an internship at this for a couple of months, but you helped me build my confidence. So don't let these people. So I didn't have any of those. Like, the work I did during that time was because God was telling me to. That's really how I saw it. It was like a, this is, I don't see anything happening for no reason.
I
saw this as a opportunity to build my love for myself. Because the only reason that a black person would have hatred towards another black person for something they are is because it's self-hatred. That's where it starts. So that's what I took it as, but nobody came to me and had an intervention. This was not things I was saying in my life. And it was jarring for everyone in my life. So
it's been interesting to hear you also talk about how colorism has showed up in your hair journey. Texturism, right? Like, you stopped bleaching your hair because you kind of realized that, one, it was damaging for your hair, but two, it was that proximity to whiteness or to looking racially ambiguous that you were enjoying or gaining benefits from and just stopped, right?
Well, I think sometimes what people forget is I went to school for biology and psychology. So it's not like I was like, oh, let me bleach my hair so I look more white. That is the subconscious of it. The thing is, what I do is, and this is what I share, like on my podcast, everything, I share the things that are shameful because I do a psychoanalysis of them. But it wasn't like a direct, the real reason I bleached my hair was because in 2017, I studied abroad in Paris. And I was like, I was young, I was ignorant. I was like, ain't no black people in Paris. I'm gonna have to cut my own hair. So I taught myself how to cut my own hair, but it looked a mess. So I was like, how am I gonna fix this? And I just bleached it because I was like, well, I can just, it's bleached. You know, like you can get away with bleached, messed up hair. That's the real reason. And so that's why, that's when I first went blonde and I went to Paris. But what I realized, I didn't realize it until years later, but I just got more views. I got more attention. Mm-hmm, I got more, like, even if you look up blonde hair right now, I will come up. My platinum routine is one of the most watched. If you go following Tariq Ali's platinum, like, it got me so much attention. So it became my brand.
Right.
And I just realized, you know, even when people ask me about my race, are you mixed or assumed? I'm like, I'm not mixed. It's just because when you bleach your hair, it becomes thinner and it has different texture. So people, I think, just had more of an affinity and I was easier on the eye because I didn't look like a regular black boy. And people are always looking for a deviation for that, just to be. So that's, I analyzed the experience and that's why I was saying, like, I think I attached to the blonde because when I did stop going blonde and I just had black hair, I was like, well, they're not going to like me. They're not going to like that because this is what got, you know, when I started going to Paris and I doing those blonde videos, that's when I started doing beauty videos. That's when I started doing makeup tutorials.
Right.
I looked more feminine, like it was more beauty
right.
rather than this.
Right.
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 And so I just was like, I have to keep the blonde because that is what makes me beautiful.
Right.
It's, it, and so I had to pull back. And with the cancellation thing, that's the work I did. I said, hold on. My hair, the way it comes out of, because I did like the way it changed my texture. Come on, y'all. Back in seventh grade in the hood, I used to do an S curl. You remember the S curl?
Yes.
Girl, get that box. Girl, that thing used to burn my head. Girl, put the pink lotion around my, yes. And I'm not the only one. I know I'm not because they used to sell out. So I know. Y'all know about the S curls. So, and everybody lied about Cherokee and my grandmama this. So I'm like, this was a thing that I saw my texture change and I was a little mixed now. And and people liked it. And I just rode that wave. But when I started realizing and getting into wanting to love my blackness more, I was like, Tariq, you don't want to take pictures when your hair is not that texture. This is how the hair is going to come out your kid's head.
Right.
This is your hair.
Right.
And in this journey, like, especially healing, I want to love every part of me, not just the parts I like. I want to like every part of me. So once I realized that, I was like, I'm not going back blonde until I love my natural hair. And it, once I started loving it, I just never wanted to go back.
Because,
wow. Like, look, this is beauty. What do you mean?
Yes.
Like, come on, darling.
And I also love your brows. We were talking about beauty, going blonde, all of that. Mm-hmm. I want to get back to growing up because you talk about your eating disorder in a way that I haven't heard a lot of men talk about eating disorders. But I'm so eager to get to the present and like the brows now, the skin now.
We're getting there, baby.
All of the beauty now. We're going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
But you have talked openly about your healing journey with your body and having an eating disorder. Trigger warning for people listening. We'll talk about struggling with eating disorders growing up. What was that time period, middle school, high school, like for you, dealing with wanting to be thin, wanting to be smaller?
Oof. That was the hardest of my childhood. It was everywhere. Being black, in white spaces you feel off, in black spaces you feel normal. Being queer, okay, your family, they know you got a little sugar in your tank. That's what they used to tell me. Yeah, I love that giggle. Because everybody, they told me that. So they know you, they accept you, whatever. And you get a little, people in public at school mess with you, whatever. But being big, it's like, you can eat a salad and be messed with. You can like literally sit there and not say anything and be messed with. It. And then think about the early 2000s. I'm a 97 baby, so the early 2000s, like, is my butt fat?
I think about the diet culture, the magazines. Remember when they called Jessica Simpson? They were like, she's huge. They would show cellulite.
They convinced me that Raven was big.
Oh, I mean,
they convinced me that so many people were big.
Some of those editors need jail time, honestly.
And so it made us think that we were even bigger than, it was just a horrible, and for me, food. So I'm from Southern Virginia, and my family's really Southern. And people, every time I say that, people are like, Virginia's not the South South. But I'm like, y'all got to remember where the South started in America, Virginia. So all of that culture and the slave house, all of, it started in Virginia, okay? Mm-hmm. They all lived in Virginia. So my family, if you go to my grandma's house right now, there's soul food on the tables. I love food. And we didn't talk about trauma. We didn't talk about things. Like I just said, I was tweeting all my stuff because we didn't talk. We ate. You seen the movie Soul Food?
Yes.
We're not going to talk about the sickness. We're going to eat this fried chicken. So I loved food. And we are all cooks. So I loved food, but I hated my body. And so I had a really hard relationship with food and fitness and my body, just all of that. It was really bad.
It broke my heart seeing those pictures of a little young you. Hmm. And then you just saying that you would just not eat for like days at a time.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
I would go whole days. Yeah.
So sad.
Yeah.
You know, like you see yeah. kids as an adult, you see kids now and you think about a young kid just starving themselves. It just breaks your heart.
And being in a house of 11 people, it was easy.
Because people weren't paying close attention.
I was invisible.
Yes.
So I was invisible, felt invisible. It just all pours into like why the internet really made sense for me. Mm. I just, my health even, I felt like I was responsible for my health, my shelter, mm-hmm. everything. Mm-hmm. I had to grow up so young. That's why, like, at 26, I don't give 26. Because it was a hard time. But I smile when I think about it, just because I have such a great relationship with that inner child, that young me, now that when I think of him, I don't feel sad. I feel great. Like, mm-hmm. I'm happy to talk about this. Mm. Yeah, because I put in the work to grow a relationship and a loving and accepting relationship with every part of me that was traumatized. So even with the canceled stuff, I'm like, please, let's talk about it. Because at that time, if you even brought that up, my hand would start shaking, literally. So all of those parts of me, it's so important to talk about it, because that's how we build relationships with them. So yeah.
And you've talked about experiencing sexual trauma, but I also want to ask if you're comfortable talking with me about it.
Oh, girl, you want to get all into it. Let's do it.
You know, I think our relationship with our bodies and how we're taught to value our bodies, a lot of that has to do with having boundaries, right? Mm-hmm. Strict boundaries. And when those boundaries are crossed without your consent, mm-hmm. that can also lead to a really difficult relationship with our bodies.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I was... trigger warning essay. I was sexually assaulted, raped by my older stepbrother for years when I was younger.
And I'm so sorry that happened to you.
I hate that I smiled in this moment. That's how I deal with my emotions, but thank you.
No, it's just...
yes.
And you were very young.
Yeah, I was. I was like...
and you're
first, second, kindergarten. It was years, God. So I don't... it was... over time, like, it was a continuous thing. It didn't stop really until I was in fourth or fifth grade. You know, because it was 11 people in the house, and like I said, I felt invisible, that's when I felt visible. So it wasn't an aggressive or, you know, like, he didn't have to fight me, you know. Mm-hmm. It was, I felt special. And it was so important to me that I shared that in the episode 16 of my podcast, because so many victims experience that, not even just from childhood.
Right.
Where Stockholm Syndrome, where your abuser, mm-hmm. you feel like that love and you feel like you need to receive that abuse to get that love too.
Right. Feel responsible, or, oh, I didn't physically fight back, so yes. therefore maybe I wanted it.
Exactly. Yeah. So I felt it was really important for me to share that I liked it. Mm. As a child, I enjoyed it. I was upset when it ended. Mm. It didn't end because I told someone. It ended because I think a friend of mine told a friend and then told my brother, which told my parents, and then it blew up. And I wasn't pissed, but I was just like, that was my time to be seen. And the conditioning, see, that's the conditioning. See, what I do when I talk about these moments is I allow those inner parts and children of me, because I spend time to actually connect with them. That's not like a metaphor. I actually like write and sit down and I let them speak. And so when he says, I needed, that was my time, that's what he believed. This was my time to be seen. This is my time to feel special. And we don't talk about the rewiring and the unlearning that has to take place in the healing journey. Like, getting over it, that's coping, right. You know, but healing, it's like you have to unlearn what that taught you, because it taught you something, mm-hmm. you know, and it taught me how to treat my body and how to view sex, how to view my body in relation to sex in men. It's so many things. And I had to question and investigate all of those things and discard what I didn't want and mm-hmm. keep what I did. So, yeah.
Has therapy been a helpful instrument for you in terms of coping with a lot of these past traumas?
So, absolutely. Therapy has changed my life. I started therapy after the cancellation thing in 2020. My aunt tried to put me in therapy when I was in high school because I was that kid from the hood, and she was like, you went through a lot of trauma, okay? But it didn't click for me. I was in high school. I didn't get it, you know? Right. But after I was having panic attacks, I was like, I need to get in therapy.
What did the panic attacks feel like, and what would trigger them?
Just thinking about it. Thinking about what people were saying about me, social media, like not even getting on it, mentions of it. It was even the first week I moved here, I got a rental car. I was in Burbank, and I think one of my friends was like, have you been on Twitter? And I had not. Twitter was off my phone at that point because I was like, this is not good for my mental health. And him bringing that up got me in my head, and I started shaking, and then I backed up into the car behind me. And so, yeah, it was really bad.
It was a very physical manifestation, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. Like, it was shaking. And I've never experienced that. I've never had anxiety and panics in that way. Like, I couldn't breathe. I had to really meditation. That's also how I got into breath work. So I had to be very, I had to learn how to take care of myself, because that was something new I had not experienced. Right. And
how often do you go to therapy now?
Every other week.
Okay.
Yeah. I love therapy. Therapy, I think everyone should be in therapy. Yeah. I do. Because I think the way that they taught us what therapy was growing up was like, if you need to fix something,
right.
If something's wrong, like, I don't need therapy. If you told a girl that she needed therapy, it's because she was crazy. So, but therapy, no, y'all. Like, therapy, and this is why it's a luxury, okay? White people have been in therapy for a long time, and that's why they got the, okay? Because what I learned about therapy is, and just like doctors, all therapists are not created equally, okay? Mm-hmm. So just because you go to therapy don't mean that she, you know, is doing the best practices. But what I've learned about therapy is this is a judgment-free space for you to exist, to express, and to have, like, and when I say that, people are like, I can do that with a friend. I don't think people,
no.
You haven't experienced.
Yeah, I can't.
You haven't experienced a space like that until you have. And it's not something you can get in 1, 2, or 3 sessions.
Right.
It's something that you continuously go to, and you are continuously open, and you're continuously honest, and you realize nothing you share changes anything.
Right.
You can exist.
Right.
And because you're able to exist, you start being more truthful. You start asking more questions about yourself. Mm-hmm. You start digging a little deeper.
I think the questions is a major part of it, right? Because a therapist doesn't give you solutions. They don't tell you what to do. They simply really mirror back to you and maybe ask some more questions and get you closer to the truth of what you're saying is. But you don't really walk away with solutions.
Exactly.
You walk away with more questions.
Exactly. And this is literally what I'm trying to teach and show with my podcast, but also I want to make it more clear. So I'm writing a book right now, and I came up with, it's pretty philosophical. I came up with a methodology for healing, and therapy, some people think that that is the one thing, but in my model, there is 3 parts to healing. And one of those is awareness. Because what I did is I looked at my healing journey and I looked at what was helping me heal. And yes, therapy was a part. But I had to look at what was it about therapy? Because not everybody believes in therapy and talk therapy. So I wanted healing to be available to everyone. Mm-hmm. And when I looked at what therapy was, it's awareness. Mm-hmm. What therapy does is make it, you become more self-aware. You become more aware of how your past is affecting your present and keeping you from having a bright future. You become aware of it. But the work is what you do after you leave. You can go to therapy every week.
Right.
And if you ain't changing or doing nothing, it's not going to change your life. Like, literally, my ex, the one when I was in an abusive relationship, he was in therapy 3 times a week.
Wow.
She was collecting her check. So, look, good for her. But this is what this is what I mean. All therapists aren't created equally. Right. And it's understanding. It's like dating. You need a different therapist maybe in different seasons. Some people are not used to expressing themselves or having the space to. So they may need just the space. But say someone who's been in therapy for 4 years and I have these spaces, they need to be challenged. Mm. They need homework. And, you know, different therapists can give different things at different times. So awareness is something that I try to do with my podcast because some people, the stigma's still there.
Right.
You know, so it's like some people don't want to go to therapy, but they'll listen to my podcast. So I'm helping them by me sharing. You see, I share everything, like therapy. Yes. And by doing that, I analyze and then I give ways in how to heal yourself and love yourself because that is the work.
Right.
That is the work.
How aware is your therapist of the work that you do? Like what it means to be a content creator and put yourself online and be judged, right? By thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions in your case of strangers at times. Like how much does your therapist understand about that as a profession?
I would say she understands it really well.
Oh, she does. She's like an LA therapist. She's like, I see a lot of creators like you.
Well, I mean,
it's like a unique thing, right?
Yeah, I think it is unique, but I think in the grand scheme of it, it's being a public figure. I think
being a
public figure in general. When the public can do what they want with your image and with your likeliness and with your what you show them, they don't know you. They know what you are sharing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think anyone can kind of grasp their idea around that psychologically.
Mm.
Well, not anyone.
Yeah, no.
Someone who has studied psychology.
Right.
But she, I share everything with her. She's been with me since 2020.
Okay.
So she's been.
She's a subscriber.
She's not. It's so funny. She's not. And a good therapist would not be.
Right.
Because that would add a little bit of bias and a little bit more information in the sessions. Mm-hmm. But so it's funny because I asked her recently, I was like, because I shouted her out very clearly in one of my podcasts. I was like, I want you to listen. She asked me, why do you want me to listen?
Mm.
Because she knows I do those things.
Right.
But she intentionally,
right,
this is sacred. Mm-hmm. Because once you start having a personal relationship with your client or with your doc, it changes, especially a therapist. Because even though you say this in a session, well, last night we was at the bar and you had, becomes something else. So that is why your friends can't be your therapist.
Yes, because
regardless, they love you. Yes. So even if you share something, I want to take care, I want to make sure you're okay. And a therapist doesn't have that connection or bias to get personal. It's just, this is what it is. This is the psychology. And this is how we're getting you to the next step. So she does not watch my content. I'm sure she has been itching probably because it's been years. But she is not.
But I do think it's interesting. I don't know if our brains have fully evolved to understand public consumption to the scale at which creators experience, right? Mm-hmm. Where you just have lots of opinions about yourself coming at you every single day and also people projecting onto you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Parasocial relationship, that is the term, where someone can meet you, and I'm sure this happens to you often, for the first time, and they feel like they know you because you've shared so much of your life. And that's beautiful, right?
I love it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's also not natural or normal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. At all.
At all.
At all. And it's a double-edged sword, right? Because I was just eating brunch the other day and a girl, one, I already know when someone knows me within the second I see them, the eyes. Mm. Because my work, I'm funny, but I'm not like a comedian. The work I do, I touch people and they go back into their lives and change it. And so that look, I always know, I'd be like, come here, baby. And they'd be like, really? I'd be like, yeah, because I can tell.
Yeah.
And so that's why I do it, because I share to help. So those people they're the reason I keep going, because I'm like, wow, I'm really changing lives. Mm-hmm. But the other side of that sword is there's a lot of people that don't get to know me and don't even want to know me. They attach to the image of me, mm-hmm. or the optic, all of that. But, you know, for me, I've gotten used to it. It's so interesting. I always thought God was holding me back on social media, you know, all my life. I was in plays, I was acting, I was doing all that in my childhood. That's what I wanted to be in Hollywood, you know? And I did YouTube, one, so I could be seen, but I was like, also, oh, if I do this, by the time I get to Hollywood, like, that'll help me out, like, in the acting and everything. So I always felt like the time on social media was God, like, I felt held back, like, God, put me in this, put me in that. And I'm actually really, really happy because this year, as I, you know, I'm my TV show, my film, my book, everything, and I'm getting more in Hollywood and doing more of that. I've been here, I've been doing this for so long. Cameras, none of this makes me nervous. You can think whatever you like about me. Right, right. We can talk about me being, I'm so yoked up with God and myself, and I was in training. I was in training on social media, so that he could prepare me for all he's about to give me in this other world. Because if I would have went into that with all the trauma I had, that's why we see, you know, I just watched the Wendy Williams.
The heartbreak.
Oh, it just made me emotional. It made me emotional because we've seen this story.
So many times.
We've seen this story. And Whitney even talked about it. Like, when everybody around you gets a check from you, your well-being, like, yeah, okay, yeah, drink some water.
No, I'm actually going to start crying right now because, and Wendy, for the icon that she is, for what she's done in radio, for what she means to us culturally. I mean, Wendy Williams is everything. I just can't even believe that this was made. I can't even believe that this was... It's beyond heartbreaking. I mean, it should not be, this should not be entertainment.
You know, this is so off track, but I love it. I know. No, it was hard for me to, I know it was hard for everyone to watch. I love Wendy. Some people are watching it for entertainment, but I think there is something, I'm actually happy about it. It speaks to how intentional we have to be about our health and our well-being, because other people, we have to.
Yes.
We set the standard.
Yes.
We set the standard. And I think when you put all of that trust and responsibility in one person, that's dangerous.
Yes.
And she did that with her husband because, and you should, right? Because your husband should be that person for you, but you should have several. And I think when she lost that,
right,
she lost herself. Because they said he was the reason she got up every day.
Right. He made sure she got to work on time. And
so what happens when you lose your lifeline?
Right. Yeah.
So it's sad. And I think seeing that, and also with how private Wendy was. How private and she was.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
It's so crazy to watch this and connect it with the years we watched her.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it feels like a huge invasion of privacy. I do want to talk about your 2024 self-expression because I love your style. I love your beauty decisions.
Thank you.
And I want to hear how you came into your personal style and how you just, you know, because we all make choices and how we want to self-present in the world. Mm-hmm. Little things, your haircut, your facial hair, your clear polish, right?
Yeah.
How did you come into your personal style?
Trial and error. Trial, let me tell you.
And that is the fact for us all.
Listen, anyone with style looked a mess at some point in their life. There's no way you can have style without going through multiple. Mm-hmm. That is how you find what is your jush.
Right.
That is how.
Yes.
That is literally how. I mean, I literally go in my closet. It takes creativity, yes, right? But it takes practice. And, you know, I really just wear what makes me feel like me.
Yes.
And it sounds so, like, cheesy when you say that because people be like, okay, how do I do that? But it's like, okay, so for me, I am non-binary. I go by all pronouns. Okay. No one panic, okay? Everyone has said the right thing, okay?
Okay. So I did check online before to make sure you're okay.
Yeah, so I'm non-binary, okay. So I identify. I think gender is really made up, and I use it because I'm a part of society. Mm-hmm. I present as a man. But when you ask me, do I identify with the male experience? No, not at all. Growing up every time, like at church, the girls over here, boys over here, ugh. Like I don't, in a group of we're men, I'll be like, we don't get, right. And I don't have a woman experience, mm-hmm. not a woman. So, but I identify with both of them in different ways. So when I go shopping or with beauty, I never limited myself based off of that. I just did what I naturally gravitated towards. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, you know, with outfits, I dress based off of how I look, and it makes it very hard for my stylist because I have style. So me and my stylist kind of work in a partnership way. Like today I dress myself a lot. But like when he does, I have to tell him how I feel. Because if I don't feel femme, if I don't feel cunty, then I wouldn't be wearing this top. I would be wearing something a little bit more relaxed. And when I'm more relaxed, I like dressing a little bit more masculine.
Yes.
So it just really depends on how I feel. And, you know, that's a freedom I didn't have when I was little because, like I said, I was obese. So we would go shopping and my grandparents, like, would let my siblings go and go where they wanted. And, they, like, Tariq, Huskies. Y'all remember Huskies? Yup. Oh, it triggers me. My family will laugh every time I say that because when I was younger, she would always be like, uh-uh, Tariq, get out them skinny jeans. Go over there to the Huskies because I was big. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't wear what everybody could wear. So when I finally got older and I just could choose what I wanted to wear, I didn't put any blocks on anything. Mm-hmm. If I feel it, I'm going to wear it.
I love dressing by intuition and by feeling. Mm-hmm. Now, the skin mm-hmm. is just on 100.
Thank you.
The skin is flawless. Talk to me about your skincare routine.
Oh, it's packed. See, it's packed in a way of, like, I first got passionate about skin in, like, 2015. Okay. So I've had some time. But I like to rotate products. I use active ingredients, your niacinamide, your salicylic acids, your all of that, right? Your AHAs, your BHAs, all of that, right? But the thing is...
Tretinoin?
Say again?
Tretinoin. Are you on a retinol prescription?
I'm not okay. on a prescription. I use The Ordinary.
Okay.
I like The Ordinary for mm-hmm. a lot of the active ingredients. Great. One, it's affordable, and they're actual, like, chemists, and it's, like, the real... It's the ingredient. A lot of these skincare, they be adding all this other stuff. And girl, give me the chemical.
Yeah. You're like, I can make a lab out of my bathroom.
Literally. Yeah. You know, literally. So I rotate those products. I think a lot of people focus on treatment. Mm-hmm. And I'm about to say I hate doing this every time, but like, because I'm going to say I'm a scientist. Because, you know, I went to school for bio and I did years of research. So when I did work in healthcare, something that was really big was like, if we always focus on treatment, then everyone will be sick. So let's get before that and focus on preventative. Mm-hmm. And that is what public health is about, right? So I have that mindset with everything. So even if I don't have fine lines to target, I'm still putting it on because let's prevent that from happening. Mm-hmm. So what happened was at the beginning, I was targeting things. I use a lot of retinols for, like, I had hypopigmentation. I wasn't wearing sunscreen. I would have, like, white spots on my face because of the sun exposure. Started wearing sunscreen. Whenever there's sun, I don't care if it's 90 or 50, if there's sun and it's touching your face, sunscreen.
Yeah. I'm happy you're talking about hypopigmentation because I think we talk a lot about hyperpigmentation, but mm-hmm. when white spots start showing up, people mm-hmm. like don't know what it is. It's you're like, is this vitiligo? What's going on?
Yep. And I got it a lot. I have freckles. So usually people who have freckles and things like that, the sun exposure changes your skin a lot. So I would get it a lot right here. And that's actually what got me into makeup was my skin because I would have a lot of hypopigmentation.
And you wanted to cover it.
And I wanted to cover it. Okay. So my first makeup product was a MAC foundation.
Okay.
And I was covering those hypo spots. And so once I started getting into active ingredients and learning what targets what, my skin started looking amazing, but I didn't stop. So now what I do is I just rotate them every day. So even if I don't necessarily need retinols, I'm putting on my retinol.
Right.
And then tomorrow, it's a salicylic acid or my lipids, whatever it is. So that's what I do.
What are your favorite go-to products currently?
Oh, for skin?
Yes.
Oh, I love Tatcha's Rice Cleanser.
Okay.
I just love it. It has the right amount of lather. And it's smooth and it's gentle. You know, with the cleansers, they're either like really bubbly or not bubbly enough. Or you know what I mean? And then some you like to use to get your makeup off. Some you like just to wash your face. But that rice cleanser, you use it for everything.
Okay.
I also love, this will change your life.
Tell me.
Dramatic pause. It's the Paula's Choice.
We love Paula's Choice.
AHA/BHA toner.
Oh.
The gray bottle.
The gray bottle.
Baby.
The gray bottle.
It will change your life. And I don't even have a deal with them, okay? And I'm telling you, I put my brother on it for Christmas. I got everybody their own personal skincare regimen created by me, and I gave them all that product.
An incredible gift.
Oh, really?
I think that's such an incredible
gift. They loved it, too.
I'm going to steal that idea. Wait, okay, but have you tried their new...
Is it the white bottle?
No, it's still a gray bottle. It's slightly different. It has mandelic acid in it.
I have to try it.
You need to try that.
Yeah, I'm one of those girls that once I like something, we locked in.
Right. Okay.
So thank you, because I need to try something new, but like... Yeah, I love that gray bottle, but I'm going to try that.
What's your go-to moisturizer and sunscreen?
Ooh, go-to sunscreen. I have different ones. So in my car, I like Sunbump. Okay. Is that the yellow bottle? Get that at Target because it's a little spray, girl. When you in the car, right. You know, because y'all forget about the sunscreen. Y'all putting it on in the morning and thinking it's lasting until 7 p.m. That ain't how it work, girl. No. So you got to look at that SPF. You got to look at how long it lasts, girl. And in that car, it's right there in my... Spray, it smell good too. It don't leave a cast. It leaves you like shiny. People be like, oh my gosh, your skin, what is that? It's sunscreen. That's one. What's another one?
Nighttime moisturizer. What's your night? I need your nighttime moisturizer.
Ooh, okay. So this one's an oil. This one is Kiehl's Nighttime.
The Midnight Recovery Oil.
You know.
Yes.
I knew. Skin? Yeah.
Yes,
Yeah. I knew you knew it. That's my favorite. Okay. I like, is it eucalyptus that's in it or lavender? I love the smell of it.
I think
and
it's
especially
lavender.
Going to sleep. It feels so supple waking up.
Yeah. Oof.
Wake up like, oh my God, my skin feels like a baby's butt. And oof, my other favorite product, Laneige.
Oh, the lip sleeping mask. It's very...
I wear that all day, girl. I live for that.
Okay. You know what?
I use it like lip balm.
I had to stop using it because I was like, I feel like I'm developing a dependency and addiction to it where like I put this on an hour ago. This is supposed to be like an 8-hour lip sleep. I'm using it all day. What is in it that is making my lips feel like I need it all the time?
Because it's amazing.
It is. Which flavor do you get? Which
the
scent?
The pink one.
The pink one.
Yeah. Which one is that?
I think it's like a watermelon. I don't know.
I don't know. I love it so
I strayed
much.
From the pink once and I got like a whitish cream one. No, the pink
I also
one.
Like the Fenty gloss.
The gloss bomb,
but
that's great.
If you want a gloss. Like, right. if you know, I think the Laneige is a good, it gives a glossy look, but it doesn't feel like lip gloss.
Yes.
And I like the Fenty gloss, but I like to have just moisturized looking lips.
Mm-hmm. I hate chapped lips. Ugh, nothing worse.
I hate anything dry.
Anything dry.
In every field. So...
Food,
all
people,
of it.
Skin.
So, yeah, I can't sleep with, you know, dry feet. I literally have to moisturize everything, so
yeah.
I'm really big on that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. What beauty moments are you eager to have that you haven't had yet? What beauty moments are in your future?
You want to know something. I'm going to tell you something. I haven't really said this like publicly, but my pilot that I wrote, I'm going to share this. My pilot that I wrote follows the manifestation of the beauty influencer world when it started. And it's inspired by like when I got on YouTube and like when the Jackie Aina, the Makeup Shayla, the Alyssa Ashley, and really getting into like where influencer marketing really boomed and where it came from. And so what I'm excited about is it's an ensemble and one of those characters is me. So I'm excited for the beauty in that. Like it's going to be next level.
Where has it been announced where this is streaming?
Oh, darling, you can't. No.
Okay, I know. Not in this town. Not in this town.
But I would love to come back when the world knows.
Yes.
Because it is a love letter to the beauty community, to beauty, to that time when everybody was watching makeup tutorials, when everybody learned how to do makeup.
Jackie Aina like taught me how to do makeup.
Come on.
Right.
So I'm really excited about it. And as a lover of beauty myself and like really teaching myself how to do makeup and then doing beauty like routines and tutorials on YouTube at that time, I'm just excited because a lot of people don't know about that.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
My last two questions. Mm-hmm. What was it like being in a Kehinde Wiley masterpiece? And then my final question, when do you feel most beautiful?
Kehinde, he reached out to me in 2019. He had watched my YouTube and was really inspired by it and hit me up and was like, you're a star. And the conversations you're having, the vulnerability you're showing, he just poured into me and has ever since. We are still good friends. Literally just went to like his last year. We had a good time. And
you are an artist's muse, you know? I mean, in the true sense, right? For an artist to see you and say, I want to reflect that in painting and make this immortal. That's what the muses were.
Yeah. It felt good because at the time, I felt really invisible, you know? And being queer and Black on YouTube, I had the views and the numbers, but we don't get the same as the white girls. So the agents don't come rushing to us. We have to prove to them. We have to beg them. We have to go through five before we sign with the six. Mm-hmm. It's just so different for us. So I felt really invisible, but to be seen, you just never know who's watching and who you're touching. And to be seen by someone who is the monument that he is, it really meant a lot. But to answer your other question, when do I feel most beautiful? I feel most beautiful when I'm loving myself. I know it sounds cheesy. But you know something that I did to build my confidence? It seems counterproductive, but literally, I stopped grooming. I stopped getting haircuts. I stopped shaving my face. I stopped getting my nails done. I wanted to see how I showed up and existed without fixing myself. And I said, Tariq, when you can love this, everything else after that, baby. So, and that really worked. Like, it was hard at first, girl, because no haircut. Come on. Like, but I had to wake up every day and not put on a hat. You're beautiful. You're beautiful. And now, so when I'm in a moment of loving myself, I think I'm just reminded of the different facets and the different ways that I look beautiful, not just one. Yeah. Wow.
Powerful. That's powerful.
Oh, thanks.
Well, thank you so much for coming and sharing your story. I mean, I'm so inspired by you. Please keep going. We love the podcast. We love the videos. We love the beauty moments, the fashion moments. And I'm so excited about your show, too.
Thank you for having me. And I want to say, as I said, I'm always going to root for my people and my Black people. And your voice, your platform, everything you do is needed and important. And I'm just always honored when people ask me to be a part of it because my art to me is like my baby. So you having me here, I really appreciate it. And you've just been a sweet person beyond this and online. And you just always been so gracious and sweet. And I really appreciate that, especially in Hollywood, girl. Because you know. So thank you.
Of course.
And God bless you. And I just wish you continued success and continued happiness.
Thank you.
You'll know real when you get it. It will say eBay Authenticity Guarantee, and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like a gem, sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. When it comes to style and luxury, eBay gets it. They're making sure the things that you love are checked by experts. Not just any experts, specialized experts. Real people who love this stuff with real hands-on authentication experience. So when you see that shiny blue check mark that says authenticity guarantee, shop with confidence. Every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. That's how you know eBay's got your back. Because when you finally step into those sneakers, put on that watch, get your real gold glow up, swing that handbag over your shoulder, or step out in that streetwear, you'll realize that feeling is unlike any other. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
I so loved hearing from Tariq, learning from Tariq. Today's episode was produced by B.A. Kasanga and edited by Tatiana Glover. Thank you all so much for listening. You can watch this episode as well on YouTube. Do not forget to subscribe to Naked Beauty on YouTube, where you can watch full episodes of the show, Naked Beauty Planet,
on social media as well, where you can get great clips of the podcast and just join our beauty community. And all of the incredible products and resources mentioned in today's episode are linked in the show notes. And you can always head to the Naked Beauty Shop My Shelf to shop previous episodes as well. Thank you all so much for your support. And I will be back next week with a new episode.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.